contribution to KPFT, we need to hear from you. With the threat of reduced federal funding for public radio, first-time contributors are more important now than ever. Call 713-526-5738 now to make your tax-deductible contribution or pledge online at kpft.org. We need your pledge. You make a huge difference in this radio station when you pledge to KPFT. Again, that number is 713-526-KPFT. Call and make your tax-deductible contribution today. You can also pledge online at kpft.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT, Houston.
KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, and Happy New Year to you. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks. Happy New Year to you.
And just sort of standard reminder stuff, vote by mail. Weirdly, Harris County still has not put a form in for 2021. They're still using the old form. So I need to call them this coming week. I was sure that they would have this set by now, but they redesigned their form, and now it's annualized. Motor vehicles, you still have until about April 13th or 14th to register vehicles. That's the current guidance. And this is a busy political week. January 5th is the Georgia runoff. Very exciting. All digits crossed. And in all likelihood, we won't have an answer until maybe the 8th. Because there will be a lot of absentee ballots to count, and I don't know if Georgia allows them to start counting before Election Day. So if they can't, it's going to be several days before we have an apparent winner or winners. Also, of course, on January 6th, because this is an exciting week, we get to watch the Republicans try to not honor the results of an election.
Hooray!
Yes, hooray, hurrah. Republicans are allowed to win elections by a little bit. Democrats must win elections by a lot. And now the precedent has been set that even when Democrats win elections by a lot, Republicans still consider that the Democrats lost. So this is now the world and the country we live in. Okay, and in security news, no, not the security where the Russians hacked the United States government and many top companies. In personal security news, Adobe Flash is officially dead. From TomsGuide.com, 3 years ago, Adobe announced that Flash Player would be ending. It's had ongoing security issues, and as of January 12th, there will be absolutely no support from Adobe for Flash. So apparently phones do not use Flash. Apple does not use Flash. New computers may not be using Flash, but there is guidance in the article. You can go to the link on how to check your computer to see if it is using Flash and how to uninstall it if Flash is on the computer. So personal security information, I strongly suggest you pay attention to it. In other news that punny-wise could be software related, would you eat a python to save the Everglades? And for those who don't know, Python is a programming language?
Yes.
So that's our segue. Best we could do. That was Andrew's idea. I came up with the story. He came up with the segue. We do the best we can. So for many years, for decades literally, I have said that if there is a nuisance species that you want to drive to extinction, find an economic use for it. Now, originally, I was suggesting things like rats and roaches, and if we could figure out a way for people to make money from them, they wouldn't be a pest anymore. However, in Florida, they have a really good one, pythons. There are pythons. They are an invasive species. Either they escaped or they were let out into the wild, and they've grown up to 18 feet long. They've become apex predators. They will even eat alligators in some cases. So the state of Florida has decided to try to promote them as a new menu item. Now, people eat eel. People do eat snake. There are restaurants that serve it. Sometimes it's rattlesnake. It could be others. Pythons apparently can be good eaten. So the story goes that Floridians could begin seeing a new slithery item on their menus because writers can't help themselves. Burmese pythons. The invasive species is so out of control in Florida that the government may begin encouraging the new meal as a way to keep the snake's numbers under control. The only catch is because they're apex predators, they may have dangerous levels of mercury. This has not yet been determined. Now, there is a python hunter by the name of Donna Khalil. She apparently has been eating pythons for a while. She does test them for mercury content. She says she has found the mercury level to be low, and you do find mercury in apex predators, tuna, for example. So the question is, is your average python low enough in mercury that it can become a diet staple? If you want to drive something to extinction, find an economic use for it. Just ask alligators. Mm. Okay, next up on the food aisle, Austin in Texas will not be allowed to restrict dine-in restaurants, the Texas Supreme Court says. Austin Mayor Steve Adler and Travis County Judge Andy Brown sought to restrict dine-in food and beverage service indoors and outdoors from 10:30 p.m. to 6 a.m. starting on New Year's Eve. The measure allowed restaurants to offer drive-through, curbside, or delivery. The Supreme Court of Texas on Friday, this is a January 1st article, blocked the Austin area orders that restricted dining in and drinking at restaurants through January 3rd. Austin, and that suit was brought by Attorney General Ken Paxton because, you know, the public interest. Austin Mayor Steve Adler, Travis County Judge Andy Brown announced the orders on December 29th to slow coronavirus infections, which are spiking in Texas. They were quickly challenged by Greg Abbott and Ken Paxton, who described the orders as, quote, needlessly oppressive because freedom. Both officials exhorted Texas restaurants to remain open in defiance of the orders, which were upheld by District Judge Thursday. Friday's Supreme Court order, however, directs the lower court to block enforcement pending any further appeal. So the state is saying you can't. The city is saying we can. The Supreme Court is saying, eh, we're sending it back to the lower court. Just hold your horses. So the Texas Restaurant Association said on Twitter that it was grateful for Abbott and Paxton's actions and that closing indoor dining would, quote, not prevent holiday celebrations, but, quote, simply move them from highly regulated businesses into completely unregulated spaces. Austin officials have voiced alarm over the availability of intensive care unit beds as cases spread across the state. The number of hospitalized coronavirus patients statewide has reached record highs. More than 27,770 people have died in Texas from coronavirus. So here we have another example of a Republican state government, which at one time was all for local control, as long as it's not too local. Hmm. That seems to be the Republican philosophy now.
I mean, the argument from the Texas Restaurant Association I find very interesting.
Would interesting equal disingenuous?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have a problem with it. Not prevent holiday celebrations, simply move them into unregulated spaces. I mean, there is the old wisdom that, you know, outlawing something doesn't get rid of it. It just, you know, makes it
drives
go
it
away.
Underground.
Yeah. But the problem with old wisdom is that it's not always applicable. with something like this, you know, first off, you know, curbside and delivery and takeout orders are still going to be open. If people want to go to restaurants for food, they can get their food. They can take it back to their homes and, you know,
and remain self-isolating.
Yeah.
To the extent they wish to.
Yeah. Are people going to gather in their homes? Yeah, probably some of them. But, you know, that was going to happen anyway. Whereas, you know, whether the restaurants remained opened or not, there were going to be people who gathered in their homes. This way, we at least, or the city of Austin, would at least have the certainty that people aren't gathering at restaurants, or at least they're not supposed to be. So, you know, it's, yes, there is some merit to the fact that people are just going to gather at home, but the problem is they were going to do that anyway. So.
Well, I think the thing to remember here is early in the pandemic, like in maybe April, Dan Patrick, our lieutenant governor, was saying, well, you know, I'm an old guy. I would be willing to die to keep the economy going and keep America great.
Uh-huh. That's what this
so
is about.
So I think that this is kind of more of that. It's like we're okay if a few of you die. Because so far in the United States, we've managed to keep the mortality rate to about 2%, whereas it can be as high as 5% or worse. But, of course, as soon as we run out of ICU beds, who knows
where
the ceiling is.
And,
so,
and,
Dan Patrick, die for the economy.
And it's never the it's never the people in power, it's never the people in privilege who end up dying for the economy for the sake of the almighty squiggly line.
People in privilege that don't wear masks and don't wash their hands sufficiently or use sanitizer.
Okay, that too.
So, I mean, we have been getting, you know, careless, I'm not going to use the word stupid, I'm going to resist that, but careless Republicans, some of them prominent, who have died from being careless about masks and presumably hand washing.
Yep.
So, at least the elite also die.
Yeah, but not as
fair to say.
It is, but certainly not at as great of numbers. So they're sacrificing the rest of us to make themselves look good. Which, you know, what's new about that?
That'll be an interesting stat to investigate. Actually, I mean, I realize they may not be getting critically ill at the same rate as, say, meatpacker workers.
Mm-hmm.
But they are kind of inviting infection by their behavior. So I don't know. It would be an interesting stat to actually see someone work on. I mean, I don't know that it would be particularly useful, but it would be intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next article from The Atlantic is The Pandemic Disproved Urban Progressives' Theory About Gentrification. What makes this a little different is I'm using the story not because of the whole lengthy story, but really just because of the opening paragraphs, sort of a futurism thing. From California to the Northeast, a funny thing has happened recently in America's most expensive metropolitan areas. Rents have gone down. Ever since remote workers began fleeing urban cores at the start of the coronavirus epidemic, whether to the Hamptons or their parents' basements, urban housing markets have been flooded with empty apartments. As a result, prices that rental units command in certain large cities have dropped 18% in Boston, 19% in Seattle, and nearly 25% in San Francisco, according to a November survey by the firm Apartment List. The cause of the drop should hardly be surprising. The pandemic has radically decreased demand for big city living while also increasing the quantity of available apartments. So, because on this show we have talked periodically about forward-looking results, forward-looking outcomes of the pandemic, long-term structural societal changes. And we talked months ago about what might happen to commercial retail space, commercial wholesale space, jobs, workers moving perhaps out to the suburbs or further, maybe even to small towns. So this is kind of more of that. We're seeing what will probably be permanent structural changes, because when people move away, it's going to be very hard to get them like back to city center. So the implications and the ramifications in terms of rental costs, housing costs, mass transit structure, mass transit fees, schedules, subsidies, highway construction and maintenance. I mean, it has this ripple effect that you really can't even describe because it just goes out into so many places. We're living through an historic moment. I mean, it's like the Black Plague, the Industrial Revolution, these kinds of epic moments in history that are transformative in ways that will be different and sometimes good and sometimes maybe not great.
Yeah.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This program was pre-recorded on January 3rd in a nameless hour of the morning. You can continue supporting this show, this station, if you are able, by going to kpft.org and clicking on the donate link. You can also text 713-526-5738, the word give, and go through an automated process. Whether it's a buck or a few bucks or a bunch of bucks, you know, $5, $100, anything you can manage monthly, a couple of bucks a month would be great. Whatever you can afford is greatly appreciated. KPFT is 100% community supported. We rely on our listeners to help us continue doing what we've been doing for the last 50 years. Also, if you cannot assist with supporting the station monetarily, it would be great if you could just tell your friends if there are one or more shows that you like, if you like Think Wing Radio, if you like blues and hi-fi, whatever it is you happen to enjoy. Tell your friends. Suggest they sample the station. Suggest they sample the shows you like. See if it might be something they enjoy. Help us build our listenership. That would be a great way of supporting the station as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Next up, eligible Texans can't get answers about the COVID-19 vaccine. It's not clear who, if anyone, has them. Now, I'm going to be turning 70 soon. I'm not going to, like, try to plunk you for a gift or something, but it's going to be sometime this month. And I'm eligible by age as well as some pre-existing conditions to get the vaccine. I have had no idea how to find out if, when, or where I can get it. So the story starts, getting the vaccine to people eligible has proven far from easy. The vaccine's rollout has been marred by poor messaging from state officials, technical errors, and logistical delays. This is, by the way, from the Texas Tribune. It is unclear whether anyone in the state knew how many doses of the vaccine had been administered. And after state officials had expressed concern vaccines were going unused and urged providers to give them to anyone who was eligible, many who met the qualifications were finding it difficult, if not impossible, to track down anyone with vaccines to give. Many counties asked Texans to sign up via an iPhone app or through an online registry, and some elder Texans, I noticed they avoided elderly, are finding those technology's owners. Now, I will say, having read to that point, the first thing I did was go to the iPhone app store and see, is there any kind of app specifically for this? I was not able to find anything. I went online. Is there like a place for Texans to sign up? There are places for Texas providers to sign up, but no place for Texas recipients that I could find to sign up. So this is getting to be challenging. Reading down the story a bit, pharmacies like CVS and HEB say they are still focusing on vaccinating medical workers or people in long-term care facilities. They don't have enough doses to vaccinate the general population, they said. CVS, which plans to spend the next 3 months focusing on vaccinating 275,000 residents and staff at 2,000 long-term care facilities in Texas, is also not yet opening up vaccine appointments to the general public. When that happens, John Frattamico, a CVS district leader in Texas, said this could occur maybe in March. Customers who sign up for a what he calls a round-trip ticket, meaning the two vaccinations, using the pharmacy's website or app or an 800 number, eligible Texans will schedule both the first and second doses on a first-come, first-served basis. CVS is encouraging its customers to download the app, which will send a push notification. So I presume it's not just CVS, but whichever pharmacy providers, vaccine providers you are patronizing, if you download their app, there may be instructions there on what they're going to do with the vaccinations, whether there will be a push notification. You might find one vendor or another might be more suitable to your particular needs or concerns. But this is going to be a private provider situation. The state is not participating, except in terms of tracking. This is going to be done basically commercially.
Right.
Texas State Rep. Donna Howard, Democrat from Austin, said more vaccine had been administered than was revealed by the registry system. She told the Texas Tribune, "I think the decision to allow the 1B group to get vaccinated was done before we had all the information we probably should have had because there wasn't the capacity to meet that new edict." So if you're in the 1B group, from age, from pre-existing conditions, for some other reason, unless you have a provider, maybe a family doctor, that can prioritize you somehow and get their hands on vaccines some way, it's going to be several months. But there are things you can do to prepare, like by having applications that will send, for example, push notifications that they have vaccine and that you can try to make an appointment with them on a first-come, first-served basis. Andrew, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, actually, I happen to have the CVS app already on my phone, and I, you know, took a quick poke around it earlier. I didn't see much about, you know, how this is going to work, you know, when you might get the push notifications or any information about the vaccines.
Yeah, I have the app also. I didn't find anything superficially either.
Yeah, so...
Which is one of the things that made this story on this show something that I felt really was important to cover.
Yeah. I mean,
because I haven't found information on it until I saw this story.
Right.
And I'm basically a full-time news consumer.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that the apps might get updated at some point. It's possible that apps from other pharmacies might already have, you know, their vaccination plans. But for CVS, at least... the information isn't there yet. So, you know, if that's your pharmacy, you know, download the app, keep checking every so often. But don't expect to get a push notification right away. You know, expect it in a few months at least.
And to be fair, there are supermarket pharmacies and other standalone pharmacies that may also have equivalent services. I don't want to make this a CVS ad.
Oh, yeah.
But it will take a little digging and a little work on your part or on the part of people that maybe are a little more technically savvy than you. Mm. Okay, next up is a story again from the Texas Tribune. You can tell it's a source I check frequently. So the title of the story is Trump called the USMCA, he named it that, the best trade deal ever. Analysts say it's not likely to help Texas during the pandemic. USMCA, they couldn't call it NAFTA 2 because Trump didn't want anything that had to do with Obama or anyone else. USMCA, he thought that was a catchy name. Personally, I think they could have called it like MexCamis. Well, at least that's an acronym.
I think they should have added the X in Mexico because then you could pronounce it USMCA. Or something. That's kind of fun to say. That's a little fun to say. Usmixka. Huh?
It's almost like Hallo Thanks Christmaka.
Yes, yes.
Which is the season that starts in the end of September and runs until New Year's.
Uh-huh.
Okay, anyhow. When the Port of Laredo passed Los Angeles to become the busiest trade hub in the country in February, optimism was high in Texas. An ongoing U.S. trade war with China meant a drop in traffic at West Coast trade hubs, while Texas land ports with Mexico are on the verge of benefiting from the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, rolls off the tongue, a 21st century upgrade to the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement, because we can't call it NAFTA 2. The new agreement was touted by Trump and some Democrats as a landmark deal that would ensure America stayed on top of the global economy. According to Ken Roberts, president and founder of World City, a Florida-based company that tracks trade, When you look at this particular free trade agreement, it's the first one, to his knowledge, that didn't really do anything to liberalize trade. It was a tweak of an old agreement. One key provision requires that a member country manufacture 75% of a vehicle's parts in order for the vehicle to be exempt from tariffs when it moves between countries. The old agreement mandated 62.5%. The new agreement also requires at least 40% of every vehicle must be produced in factories where workers are paid at least $16 per hour. I don't know what currency that's calculated in. The agreement, which will be reviewed every 6 years, went into effect on July 1st, but the pandemic is clouding the ability to forecast its immediate impact on Texas trade. Current forecasts show more than a 50% decline for the Texas ports of entry because of pandemic-induced disruptions. Some trade advocates point to some new projects, including construction of cold storage warehouses along the border and the issuance of a permit for a new cross-border rail line through Laredo, as signs that the agreement is having an impact already. Now, I will start my comments by saying that I've been a supporter of the NAFTA agreement since 94, because my feeling is that Canada and Mexico should be our number one foreign policy priorities. What makes their economies strong, makes their governments stable, ultimately is good for the United States. We don't want to be at an economic disadvantage vis-a-vis Canada and Mexico, but to the extent that we can have a strong, affluent, democratically stable, economically viable common market among the three of us, I think that that is the best foreign policy outcome for the United States. I think that eventually these tweaks to the plan will be good for all three countries. The $16 per hour, the 40% of every vehicle must be produced in factories where workers are paid at least $16 per hour. When you're converting U.S. dollars to Mexican pesos, that's a big pay boost for Mexican workers. $16 an hour, if that's in Canadian dollars, that's basically worth about $14, $13 an hour U.S., but still, by Canadian standards, a decent wage. And I think that that's part of what makes the treaty acceptable to the U.S. and Canada, because wages can be so severely undercut in Mexico. I think it's an interesting story from both an economic standpoint and, an economic standpoint, an international trade standpoint, and a COVID standpoint. I think all of those things make this an interesting story. Andrew?
Well, my...
Closer to the mic?
Oh, sorry. My main thought is that I happen to wonder if the fact that the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement didn't do a whole lot to liberalize trade, I wonder if that's more of a blessing than we realize. Because, you know, from what I know, generally the more liberal trade is, the less liberal workers' rights are. And, you know, like these sorts of free trade agreements are prime opportunities for governments to undercut workplace rights, undercut wages, and undercut organizing. And, you know, we have several states in the United States where right-to-work laws are in place. Texas is one.
Or, as I sometimes call them, right-to-be-screwed laws.
Exactly. So, you know, the state of organized labor is and workers' rights in general is really not great here in the U.S.
Well, but that isn't directly impacted by this agreement. I think the 40% target in terms of wages is to help make it more palatable for the United States and Canada, because Mexico can so easily undercut wages. But what this also does is force Mexican wages up, and hopefully down the line what you'll end up with is something closer to economic parity among the three countries. Now, among the objections, and not just from the United States, you know, there are a lot of Mexican workers and companies that felt that this was going to unfairly impact them by stronger, more competitive North American companies. Mexican farmers feel like they suffered under this because of the agribusiness in North America, in the United States and Canada. technically Mexico is part of North America. I certainly am wary of free trade agreements, but I also think that people sometimes overlook the fact that for the United States, at least up until the last several years, free trade agreements have been strategically valuable to the United States. I think they've been terribly abused, and I think we've exported a lot of our manufacturing capability outsourcing, and I think that's really, really bad strategically. But one of the advantages of trade agreements with the United States is that it ties countries to us strategically, whether it's economically or militarily, whether it has to do with being a market or being a source or providing military hardware to them, which ties us again to them strategically. I think that we certainly have to re-examine our strategic goals. I mean, we should have been doing this 30 years ago, but we certainly have to re-examine the strategic goals of free trade agreements, not only in terms of what works for American business, which at least theoretically is supposed to be good for America as a whole, but also in terms of reinvesting in our capability to make basic stuff, which during COVID we have found more visibly than perhaps has ever been obvious before, that we've exported our ability to provide for ourselves, which is crazy in what is supposed to be the most powerful economy in the world. It's like, great, we're a post-industrial economy. That means we don't make stuff anymore, which means that when people don't send us stuff, we're screwed. That's nuts. So not against free trade agreements, but we need to be smarter about the kinds of agreements we make in terms of both the benefit to American workers and the strategic good of the United States. And businesses presumably will do well in that environment regardless. They always find a way. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. You can stay in touch with us, even though these shows are pre-recorded now, even though we can't take live callers, which we miss greatly. You can still be in contact with us. You can follow me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio and make comments or respond to my tweets there. You can follow me on my Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio. You can write to me at thinkwing@kpft.org. I switch between the email addresses, but either one will get to us. thinkwing@kpft.org. We would love to hear from you. Ideas, suggestions, comments, complaints, it's all good. We would like to know what you think of what we're doing. And, of course, you can support KPFT by going to kpft.org. And I shouldn't go through it that fast. kpft.org. I complain when people do that. kpft.org. Click on donate.
Yep.
Okay. Andrew, was there something you wanted to add?
Yes. I have my own social media, yes, of course. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE. And spelled the same on Tumblr at dominatei.tumblr.com.
Okay. Next up, there is a website I follow. It's a Houston website, offthecuff.com. Charles Kuffner writes that. And it pays to keep an eye on his website. He covers local politics, state politics, finds articles that he cites, does interesting commentary. And in this particular case on offthecuff.com, he entitled a piece, "The Census Bureau Will Miss Deadline That Would Allow for Apportionment Shenanigans." And he cites an article from AP News, "Census Bureau to Miss Deadline Jeopardizing Trump Plan." The Census Bureau will miss a year-end deadline for handing in numbers used for divvying up congressional seats, a delay that could undermine Donald Trump's efforts to exclude people in the country illegally from the count, if the figures aren't submitted before President-elect Biden takes office. The Census Bureau plans to deliver a population count of each state in early 2021, as close to the missed deadline as possible, but internal documents obtained earlier this month by the House Committee on Oversight and Reform show that Census Bureau officials don't expect the apportionment numbers to be ready until days after Biden is inaugurated on January 20th. Once in office, Biden could rescind Trump's presidential memorandum directing the Census Bureau to exclude people in the country illegally. The Constitution does not make a distinction. They just want, the Constitution wants a count. Whether you're here legally, illegally, citizen, green card, visa, they want a count. An influential GOP advisor had advocated excluding them from the apportionment process in order to favor Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. According to someone who oversaw the 2020 census in preparation as the agency's leader during the Obama administration, if these issues are not addressed, then it is very possible that stakeholders, including the Congress, may not accept the results for various purposes, including apportionment. Missing the December 31 target date means the Census Bureau is choosing to remove known errors from the 2020 census instead of meeting the legal deadline. Charles Kuffner says it's one less way for Trump to screw things up beyond his own administration's reign, and we should all be happy for it. Charles goes on, there's also a bill in the Senate to extend the deadline for census results by 4 months, which the Census Bureau had asked for back in April, but which got sidelined by, among other things, the usual Trump indifference. Kuffner presumes that we'll have a better chance of passing the law if Democratic candidates can win in Georgia, but we'll see.
I remember hearing about the delays that the 2020 census was having.
Yeah, we probably talked about it.
Yeah. I actually...
And the shenanigans.
And the shenanigans. I actually applied myself to be a census taker. They never got back to me. But
don't take it too personally.
Yeah.
I mean, that assumes they wanted to count.
That's true. But yeah, I suppose I'm glad in a way that the census got delayed then, because it gives Biden the opportunity to stand in the way of Trump's plan to exclude undocumented people from the count.
Basically all people of color, as well as undocumented, because people of color tend to be poor, and poor people tend to not respond to census requests as enthusiastically, and often need door-to-door visitation in order to be counted.
Yeah,
because... So, especially with the COVID pandemic, all of that was in jeopardy, which is why the Census Bureau requested extensions.
Right. I don't know if it's something I should be glad for, because clearly it wasn't supposed to happen like this. The census was
If something you should be glad for.
The census being delayed. The census wasn't supposed to be delayed, but, you know, we've stumbled into this bit of good fortune, I guess, as a result. So I don't know. I don't know how to feel.
It's one of those things where perversely the pandemic may have saved us from serious apportionment.
Yeah, shenanigans, I think.
Shenanigans. Shenanigans is a good word.
Yeah.
Otherwise the Trump regime would have just forced this through and they would have certified the count as basically an undercount.
Mm.
So this may save us 10 years of greater injustice, governmentally speaking.
Mm.
So the next couple of stories sort of bring to mind my question, and it's a thought question, it's provocative. Is the Republican Party simply becoming the Sedition Party? The reason that I frame it that way is this. A story from the New York Times. Mike Pence welcomes the futile bid by GOP lawmakers to overturn the election. Vice President Pence signaled his support as 11 Republican senators and senators-elect said they would vote to reject President-elect Biden's victory. The announcement by the senators and Mr. Pence's move to endorse it reflected the groundswell among Republicans to defy the unambiguous results of the election and indulge Donald Trump's attempts to remain in power with false claims of voting fraud. The senators' opposition to certifying Mr. Biden's election will not change the outcome, but it guarantees that what would normally be a perfunctory session on Capitol Hill on Wednesday will instead become a partisan brawl in which Republicans amplify specious claims of widespread election rigging that have been debunked and dismissed for weeks, even as Donald Trump has stoked them. The conundrum is especially acute for Mr. Pence, who, as president of the Senate, has the task of presiding over Wednesday's proceedings and declaring Mr. Biden the winner, but has his own future political aspirations to consider. On Friday, a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit brought by House Republicans led by Texas Representative Louie Gohmert to pressure Mr. Pence to do otherwise and instead unilaterally overturn the results. On Saturday evening, Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff, issued a statement saying that Mike Pence, quote, shares the concerns of millions of Americans about voter fraud and irregularities in the last election. The vice president, quote, welcomes the efforts of members of the House and Senate to use the authority they have under the law to raise objections and bring forward evidence before the Congress and the American people on January 6th. I will point out, the media is actually equally bad about this. I constantly make a distinction between voter fraud, the terms voter fraud versus election fraud. Republicans never use the term election fraud, and the media seems to use voter fraud interchangeably with what would otherwise be election fraud. So I want to make clear what I believe the distinction to be. Voter fraud is an individual voter or an individual person going in to vote fraudulently, misidentifying themselves, they're not a citizen, they're voting in the name of a dead person. That is voter fraud, a person going into a polling place and voting illegally. Election fraud is institutional. So, for example, voter suppression is a form of election fraud. Purging voter rolls of people that are legally allowed to vote, but finding some excuse to say, well, you know, they haven't voted recently, they haven't voted in the last presidential election, we haven't gotten mail from their address. These things are voter suppression. When a referendum was passed in Florida allowing felons who had served their time, when a referendum was passed by voters allowing ex-felons to regain the right to vote, the Republican legislature in Florida has been doing everything they can to prevent that referendum from being honored. And it was overwhelmingly passed. That is a form of election fraud. It's disenfranchising people. It's finding ways to suppress votes. It's finding ways to exclude votes. It's things like not only signature matching, but having to get a witness to verify that you are who you are. So now a mail-in ballot, you have to have a neighbor or a friend or somebody verify your ID. I mean, the last time I had to do that for somebody was an end-of-life order where I had to see an ID in order to witness it. That's election fraud. Voter fraud, different thing. Do not use those terms interchangeably. There's actually a whole lot more to this story. I don't know that I necessarily want to read through all of that, but there's another piece. Before I go on to the next part of this sedition question, Andrew, anything you want to add?
I noticed that it says later in the article that the group standing to raise objection when the results are certified is led by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas.
Because Republicans are so pro-democracy.
Yes, of course. Ted, I want to talk to you. I want to talk directly to you because I know you're listening. Because of course you listen to KPFT.
Of course.
Get a hobby, man. Come on. you've tried this a number of different ways, and it hasn't worked out. And I really think, you know, you seem like the kind of man who would like golf. Maybe give that a try. You know, spend some time on that instead of, you know, interfering with elections. I think you'll find it more rewarding.
Or as a lawyer, as someone who is trained in the law, obviously verbally articulate, whatever you think of his political views, not a dumb guy, maybe think of being a constitutionalist by starting with actually honoring election results. I mean, I realize that could be a stretch, but yeah. There it is. And we know you're listening.
We know you're listening.
We know you're listening. Okay, so just to get to kind of the end of that story, these baseless claims of voter fraud or election fraud have already been examined and dismissed by Trump's own attorney general, dozens of courts, I think the number is about 60, and election officials from both parties, said Mike Wynn, a spokesman for Mr. Biden's campaign. The other story that I think is a part of this is from the New York Times. Trump calls Georgia Senate races, quote, illegal and invalid. Trump continued his assault on election integrity, baselessly claiming the presidential results and the Senate runoffs in Georgia were both invalid, which could complicate GOP efforts to motivate voters. Trump took to Twitter Friday evening to make the unfounded assertion that the two Senate runoffs in Georgia are illegal and invalid, an argument that could complicate efforts to convince his supporters to turn out. Mr. Trump has continued to make the false claim that Georgia's election system was rigged against him in the November 3rd election. Some Republican leaders are afraid that his supporters will take the president's argument seriously and decide that voting in a corrupt system, quote unquote, is not worth their time. Some strategists and political science experts in the state have said Mr. Trump's assault on Georgia's voter system may at least partly be responsible for the relatively light Republican turnout in the conservative strongholds of Northwest Georgia in the early voting period that ended Thursday. So again, at what point do we start to call the Republican Party as an institution? Because I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, okay? But as an institution, the Republican Party seems to have come down as being anti-election results if they lose. Now, I've made a joke about this in the past, that when Republicans win, the results are legitimate, and when Republicans lose, it's rigged. It's not so much a joke anymore. This seems to be their modus operandi. At what point is this seditious? At what point is this outwardly damaging a democratic election system? What does it take for them to admit they lost? Can it be close? Can a Republican ever lose a close election? Or does it have to be overwhelming? Does a Democrat have to win by 5%, 8%, 10%? Joe Biden is the first president that I can remember in at least 30 years, maybe more, who actually got over 50% of the vote. I mean, think about that. Most presidents win with a plurality. Biden actually won with over 50% of the vote. And even that's not enough for the Republican Party to admit that they lost. This is a problem. And the question is, at what point does it cross from being a problem to being actually seditious to the system? Just my thinking. Andrew?
You ask, what will it take for Republicans to accept the results of an election that they lose? I think maybe they never will.
That's a problem.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that, you know, there has been, you know, there might have been some point in the past when, you know, the mainstream conservative party in American politics was, and I use that wording specifically because I want to open this up to the entirety of American history, because I don't know when that time will have been. But I think there may have been a time in American politics when the mainstream conservative party was willing to play fair, was willing to respect the process. But I don't think we're in that. I don't think we've been in that for a very long time. I think the Republican Party has been, you know, hell-bent on, you know, getting things their way, doing whatever the hell they want, and, you know, getting rid of anyone who gets in their way in whatever form, you know, they choose. And I think that, you know, the people who have wanted to be bipartisan, reach across the aisle and that sort of thing, have been, you know, seeing what happens when you do that, when you give them that chance. They take it, they run with it, and they don't meet you on the same ground. So, you know, that's my belief.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. You can listen online at kpft.org. You can also podcast the show. If you go to archive.kpft.org, you have all the shows from KPFT. Some of them are available for 2 weeks. Some are available for up to 2 months. Many of them can be podcast. This show can be podcast. Just find it. You can do a search by name, archive.kpft.org, and you can have us drop on your phone. It's that easy.
Yeah.
Let's see. So next, you probably heard that Speaker Pelosi's house was vandalized with graffiti and a pig head and pig's blood, and the writing on there was cancel rent, we want everything, UBI, referring to universal basic income. And there was a circled A along with the graffiti paint. Then a day or two or three later, Mitch McConnell's house was also vandalized with graffiti paint. Where's my money, which was misspelled. There was also other graffiti, which weirdly was not actually mentioned. McConnell kills poor people, I think, was one of them. And you can read it in the good photos, but for some reason it's not reported. Here's a thing, though, I wanted to point out. We don't know who did this vandalism, and we don't know what their motivations are. As what I think is the best example, when you look at Pelosi's house, why would anarchists, which is that circle A, that's their symbol, why would anarchists write $2,000, cancel rent, we want everything, anarchists? Just because you see a circled A, that doesn't mean anarchists did the vandalism. I don't have any particular love for anarchists or their political philosophies, but we have to look at this objectively. When you look at the comments look more right-wing. Like, we want everything. We want you to cancel the rent. We want our $2,000. Footnote, anarchists.
The sort of caricature, conservative caricature of left-wing politics.
Exactly. Mm. So I would be more inclined to think, and especially since Pelosi is more in favor of things that trend more toward those things, that doesn't seem like the kind of stuff that anarchists would write, and she doesn't seem like the kind of person they would choose to do that. And the whole pig's head, pig's blood thing, I don't think that's so much anarchist either. The symbolism just doesn't work for me. Hmm. That seems more right-wing extremist to me. Now, as for Mitch McConnell, that could have been lefties, or it could have been righties trying to make lefties look bad, which would be the same reason that they might do it at Pelosi. I mean, this stuff is very complicated. You can't take it at face value. On some level, it's just propaganda, and it can be making someone else look like the bad guy in order to advance your agenda, kind of like the protests and riots that you've had in cities like Portland, where you've had anarchists join in with peaceful protesters, where there was an exchange that was once reported where a Black Lives Matter person was watching someone break a window and say, no, we don't want to do that because we want to make a peaceful protest. And the anarchist responded, just because we're out here with you doesn't mean we have the same objectives as you. So this stuff gets very fuzzy. And just because someone signs something a certain way, or just because somebody merges in with a protest a certain way, doesn't necessarily mean they're trying to send the same message. Andrew?
I mean, about the graffiti, I agree with you. I think, some of the messages on Pelosi's door, the reference to universal basic income specifically, because that seems like a more liberal policy to me, something that anarchists aren't as in favor of. Rent cancellation, I have heard anarchists calling for. I mean, disclosure, I'm an anarchist sympathizer. I've mentioned that on this show before. And while I wouldn't call myself an expert, I think I have a decent sense of what anarchists in the United States are, you know, what their political aims generally are. And so I definitely think that, you know, I can't rule anything out, of course, because I wasn't there. I don't know the full story. But I do think that there's a very good chance that this is some sort of, you know, smear campaign by the right on, you know, not just liberals, but anarchists as well.
Right-wing extremists smearing left-wing extremists. I mean, it's kind of funny when you think about it, except it's not.
Mm. Well, you know, the right doesn't have to be extremists to do this sort of thing. You know, while I, you know, I can't encourage anybody to go out and break the law, and so I'm not going to. Conceptually, I think this sort of thing is cool a bit. And I think it's, you know, comparatively to the rest of history, what groups of people in a society tend to do when they are unhappy with their leaders, it's tame. That's assuming that this is genuinely anarchists who did this.
Well, let me ask you, when you say it's cool, I would ask you to sort of define what is cool, especially when both of us are kind of inclined to agree that this is probably framing anarchists by righties.
Right. So conceptually, the idea of graffitiing the personal property of a person in power who is doing something that is harming people, like that vague concept, I'm fine with. And that's more what I mean, and even somewhat admirable of. That's more what I mean. I think because it's unclear who exactly did this, you know, if it was anarchists, you know, okay. If it wasn't anarchists, well, that's a problem.
At least sign your name to something if you're going to say it, as opposed to signing somebody else's name.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I mean, at least your ideology.
Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host and my indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson. And we'll cross our fingers that our news next week will be good. I hope you have a happy new year and continue to take care. Speak to you next week.
See you later, folks.
You may have been in your car looking for news coverage or some new music. Maybe you were at home flipping the dial looking for something different. Your radio may have settled on KPFT and stayed there. If you're new to this station, here's how community radio works. We rely on listeners, not advertisers, for the money that we use to operate our station. We hold membership drives a few times a year, and we ask for you to support our work with a pledge. If you give a call to 713-526-4000 and ask for the membership department, you can pledge an amount of your choice to support KPFT. You've come to rely on us, but we rely on you. That's 713-526-4000. Ask for the membership department and support KPFT, or go to kpft.org to pledge. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.